Good. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, Grant laid out what's the data out there, what's going on. It's a very frightening picture, but there is some hope. Terry went through his challenge and talked about some of the pledges people were making. What we decided to do is, with support from Grant and CDC, was to actually do an inventory of the 50 states. So we knew what they pledged, what's actually going on in the states. And that is something that the data is now being finalized. If you have any questions, Leslie Erdelak here can answer that as she's working on that. But we want to see what's actually going on in the states. So we did that survey. And again, I have no relationships to disclose. Thank you. ASTO Propaganda. As you know, we represent the chief public health officials in the 50 states, D.C., and the U.S. territories and freely associated states, so cover 10 time zones, fascinating group of people. So we're going to talk about a little about the preliminary data from the survey we did, and then from that we were creating state profiles so that you could look at any given state to see which of these elements are in place or being planned within the state. And then I'll tell you later where we hope to go from that. You know, I don't have to go over again how much of a problem this is. Prescription opioid abuse is an opioid abuse, which is why, as Dr. Klein said, we need to take a very comprehensive approach here. If we simply crack down on one type of opioids, we push people into other types of opioids, unless we prevent, unless we treat, and provide opportunities for recovery. So the inventory was sent out in May, 32-item survey. The survey was derived from recommendations from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, CDC. There's other organizations. There was CDC put something out of OSTILS looking at the states and policies, and TIFA did the same. We collected that to say, okay, what are the promising practices out there, some evidence-based, some promising, and that's what we inventoried the different states on. We had a pretty good response rate, 51. A couple of states didn't respond, but we also were fortunate in getting some of the U.S. territories' responses from them. So again, comprehensive prevention, treatment, recovery, monitoring, surveillance, control, enforcement. And then we added neonatal abstinence syndrome. And it's one of the interesting things about the health officials is that they oversee everything within public health. And so rather than a siloed approach of I only work on prescription drugs or I only work on infant mortality, a couple of years before, we had done this Healthy Babies, and it's still going on across the country, looking at preterm birth and some remarkable accomplishments there. But in that work, we started to see and look at what was happening with babies and started to see this neonatal abstinence syndrome, babies being born withdrawing from drugs. And the assumption is, of course, oh, these terrible mothers are abusing drugs, and that's why their babies are withdrawing. As it turns out, when we looked at that data in some of the states, at least two states have looked at it pretty extensively. In one state, over 50% of the women whose baby had neonatal abstinence syndrome had been legitimately prescribed the opioids by their physician. In another state, of the women who had babies with neonatal abstinence syndrome, over 70% of the women had been prescribed an opioid by their doctor. Now, that may not have been their only source, but they were getting it from the healthcare system. So I again want to stress that there is a problem in our system, and it is really a mistake to look at this as a bad doctor or bad patient issue. It is a systematic problem. Just to hit on neonatal abstinence syndrome for another minute, as far as we know, in few states, and Terry, I don't know about yours, do the obstetricians actually check the prescription drug monitoring system when a woman presents with a pregnancy or along the way? When records go up to labor and delivery, does anybody check the prescription drug monitoring system? When a pediatrician gets a baby that's going bad, in many systems, a pediatrician is not the physician of record. They're unable to check the mother's record to see if that mother is on opioids. So there are all these systematic problems here. Now, FDA recently put out a black box warning to opioids for pregnancy. But, you know, if you remember the Accutane, the acne drug, when we prescribe Accutane for people that are in childbearing age, we also prescribe a contraceptive. Are women given an informed consent in this country when they're childbearing age when they're prescribed an opioid? They're not. So again, just want to make this point. This is a systematic problem. The other interesting thing about that, I love this topic, I'll get off in a second, is what do you do when a mom self-identifies? Certainly you want to create an atmosphere where a mom can come in and say, listen, I have an opioid problem or I'm taking some opioids. What happens in many states is they then get reported to Child Protective Services, they lose their baby. In fact, very unfortunately, in one state, Tennessee, one of the enlightened legislatures introduced and a law was passed criminalizing this. So the mom is a criminal, the baby goes to jail. That's, again, a systematic problem we've got to deal with. We have to create a safe harbor for people so they can self-identify and babies can be treated. Just to show you the comprehensiveness of the approach that has to be taken here. So, back to the survey. Three things we looked at: policies, because we really do believe that, you know, policies, you can affect millions of people. Programs, you might affect thousands of people. So policies are incredibly important to look at, especially when you look at systematic change. We asked that, who is someone in the state doing this activity, and who? It doesn't necessarily have to be the health department. A lot of this is about convening and coordinating. And then general information about different things that we're looking for, such as the Narcan, the drug disposal, things like that. We asked if this was being done in your state. No, but there's some degree of action, some moving toward it, or some planning going on. And then others, no, we're just not doing anything. So I'm just going to give you a couple of samples here rather than go through the all of them, because, again, it was very comprehensive. So primary prevention. It's been a very interesting, as we've been engaged in this over the years, how people immediately tend to go toward monitoring and enforcement, which are critically important. They have to happen. But you kind of shake their head when you talk about prevention. Well, how do you prevent this? Because they don't quite understand where it all comes from. When people do talk about prevention, they often talk about prescribing guidelines for doctors, continuing education. That's all very important. But there are some very, very good community-based prevention programs, which we tend to hear much less about. When I became Commissioner of Health and the different agencies, we had substance abuse in our agency in Vermont, and all the different groups came in to talk about their programs, I actually learned more about community-based prevention from our substance use abuse colleagues than I did from anyone else in the Department of Health. They really have good experience. There is a strategic prevention framework, grants, that SAMHSA puts out. Now, those traditionally have been aimed at alcohol and marijuana and tobacco. They do have elements of that now designed toward prescription drug. They're still being evaluated. But in communities where the original program was called SPIFSIG, they showed statistically significant decreases in alcohol, marijuana, and tobacco use in the intervention communities compared to the non-intervention communities. This stuff works. Interestingly, and I learned this from Leslie, the USDA has the Cooperative Extension Service. You may have heard about that. It's an educational program. It's based out of the land-grant universities in every state. They have a system called PROSPER, Promoting School, Community, University Partnerships to Enhance Resilience. And it is a youth resilience program, which is really what this is all about. And it does look at things like truancy, illegal behavior, things like that. But it also looks at illicit drug use. Now, they have had a component for a while on prescription drugs. And in after a five-year follow-up point, they found that there was a decrease in the lifetime prescription opioid misuse and a lifetime prescription drug misuse, so the non-opioids. It really can work. And what we also have to realize is that, interestingly, we in public health may not have this expertise in this area. We have to reach out to the Extension Service and the agricultural departments and the substance abuse. But it's very important. If we can prevent this problem, we don't have to deal with it later. So where are these prevention programs happening? Schools, primary care settings, community-based. So it is happening out there. We really need to partner with these different groups and promote it. I just talked about these different programs, very important community-based youth resilience programs. Using the data to identify high-risk populations or communities. So in public health, we have informatics and we have infomorticians. They're people that embalm data. And a lot of these programs take the PDMP data and it just sits there in a file. The better and best practices now, as Terry had talked about, I think, did you talk about Ohio, where you're actually identifying patients that are at risk based on the milliequivalents of morphine or the doctors and how many milliequivalents of morphine they're prescribing or patients that are seeking more prescriptions from more than one doc. Now, if we were to do this optimally and right, we would be able to have a trigger or a signal when somebody goes to that second or third doctor. I should have got triggered this summer. Right, and got a phone call, and those docs should have got a call. It didn't happen. But if we can early on identify these people and reach out, we may actually prevent some of the addictions that occur within the healthcare system, where we make patients into addicts. We may also identify people who are already further along in their disease and do need treatment. So again, this is a best practice. 50% now are saying that at least one agency is doing this. It really has to move to 100%. Opioid prescribing. This has been very helpful for docs. My brother's an ER doc out in Washington State. He loves this thing. Because when a patient comes in, a drug-seeking patient, or perhaps a patient that's being addicted and asking, he can show them, this is the guidelines the state has sent me. I can't do what you're asking me. What else can we do here? They like it that way. As opposed to, we're not hearing back from the docs, this is cookbook medicine, don't tell me to do it. They're saying, protect me with a guideline. Very helpful. And again, these need to be developed with the docs, together with them, and the nurses, and everyone else is prescribing. Very popular. The naloxone training programs, training is great. Of course, before that, you have to have the policy, allowing first responders, allowing families, allowing drug users to have access to naloxone. But the 63% of states are doing the training programs. I have no doubt this is going to become the norm across the country over the next few years. The first department in the country to do this, I think, was in Massachusetts. I can't remember the name of the town, but I talked to the chief of police there, and very controversial. The docs, a lot of law enforcement came from, these are criminals, these are bad actors, what are we doing? But they begrudgingly went along, they got trained. And he told me the first person they saved was a middle-class gentleman who had had surgery the day before, went home, took his medicines, and overdosed. Completely changed the mindset of law enforcement to say, oh my God, this isn't just about people living in the street. This is a real problem for everybody. And I think if people can accept that this is not a bad actor criminal problem, this is a problem for everyone in this country, we'll get this much further along. We really need to destigmatize. Statewide treatment task force. Now, this is around treatment. There are many task force, more task force around the problem. But to actually have treatment is important. I think, Michael, I don't know if you're still here from Rhode Island. They passed, in Rhode Island, they actually passed legislation. I think you have to evaluate somebody within 3 hours of a referral. And the insurance companies must approve it within a very short period of time also. So no more of this, because in my practice, when I was practicing, there just was no one to send someone to if they had a problem. I ended up sending them to the ER because there was no doctor. So really we need to work on this access to treatment, the quality of treatment, and we simply don't have enough. I agree with Terry. To see treatment falling is really probably not a good thing. So you can see here the broad base of the treatment. Some very interesting things going on in law enforcement, where some of the law enforcement departments are now having social workers or evaluators on them. So if they come across somebody, they don't necessarily just haul them off to prison right away. They do an evaluation and see if treatment is appropriate. Some great things going on with drug courts, or sometimes called treatment courts, where rather than sending a kid or somebody to drug university, i.e. prison, they go to a supervised treatment program where they can get back on their feet. They don't necessarily then have a criminal record where they can't vote, they can't get a job, they can't live in public housing. So we're seeing some very exciting things going on there. The screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment, again, very important. Almost 80% of states are beginning to implement it. Primary care is a great setting to do it. It has to be quick in primary care, and you have to have somewhere to send the person. That's two things are both a problem. I'm a primary care physician. When you're seeing 35 patients, it's really hard to do this. So having team-based care is important. But also, if you need to refer, there has to be somewhere to refer them to. The waiting lists in the public programs are way too long. But important, and also, trauma centers, ERs, as Terry mentioned, someone coming in multiple times with questionable injuries. Mm-hmm. Workplace is important. So ESPRT, very important to look at. Law enforcement, as I mentioned before, we have to have law enforcement. Sometimes people in the treatment community or public health are a little uncomfortable standing next to a uniformed officer. The most powerful message is when you have a public health person or a white coat standing next to a uniformed officer, people will listen to one or the other of you, maybe both. But there is a criminal element to this, too, that we do need to address also. So as you can see, the law enforcement is really changing. For our department, we were trying to implement take-home methadone in the state, and the governor basically said, if you can go get the Commissioner of Corrections and the Commissioner of Public Safety to come back in here and agree with you that we should do take-home methadone, I'll do it. And so it took 6 months negotiating with those parties. Interesting, corrections did not want to do treatment because they said there's no treatment in the community. If we offer treatment in corrections, people get arrested to get treatment. It's true. They will. People want to be treated in opioids. And public safety, what turned it around there was one of the old-time lieutenants on the drug task force finally said to the commissioner of public safety, "Commissioner, we are not going to bust our way out of this problem. We have got to treat these people." And police are moving in that direction now. As Terry talked about prescription drug monitoring, that was the Department of Justice, Hal Rogers program. Initially, those were placed in law enforcement. Over the past 8 years or so, those are now preferentially placed in public health. So even justice is seeing this as a health problem, not a law enforcement. But law enforcement is clearly your partner on this one. I talked about neonatal abstinence. A little bit disappointed that only 8% of the states are really comprehensively addressing this. This is a terrible, terrible problem. These children do badly in long-term follow-up. One state found that if you, of their children born in their, it's 10 care, I think I can say that, because they publicly said, use the data, of children born into 10 care, which is their Medicaid population, among the whole population, about 2.5% of those children will go into Child Protective Services. If the child is born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, it's over 25% of those kids go into Child Protective Services. And this was before that law. So what we're doing with neonatal abstinence syndrome is creating a multi-generational problem here. Kids don't do well in Child Protective Services. So we really have got to prevent this, both up front on the healthcare side, but through treatment and recovery for the moms. So what we're going to do with these surveys is we are putting creating state profiles. This will be up sometime end of December, Leslie, on our webpage, so that states will be able to look there. You'll be able to look at your state and say, okay, of these menus of things, what are we doing? What are we not doing? And in either case, you can look at other states to say, what other states are trying to do the same thing? Let's talk to them. Or what other states are doing this and we're not? Or potentially, what are we doing that other states aren't and we can teach them? So what we're trying to do is create a tool for sharing information across the states. Where we really want to go with this so we can get the funding is so that you could click on one of these questions and it would take you to resources. So you say, I want a funding effective primary prevention targeting substance use. How do I do that? Click on it. And you see what other states are doing, what the literature is, what the evidence is around that as a way of driving the behavior. Because when it comes down to it, we're trying to drive action here, not just a paper that maybe we'll get out of it too. So with that, understanding what's going on out there, again, what's in place, assessing the different policies and practices, but again, really figuring out how to share that information, how to drive action is what we're after. So with that, say thank you. And Linda, how would you like to proceed from here?
Yes.
I can take the first question. When CDC does report out on...
I'm going to ask you to speak in the mic because they actually record.
Sure. When CDC reports out on prescription drug opioids, we typically also present data on, other substances, benzos, like alcohol, et cetera. So we do that tracking. It's available if you go to the CDC website. Some of our most recent trend data show the data of opioids and benzos and other sedatives.
We're lining up in order for you, so we can just go one down the other. So I'm going to try to address part of your second question and editorialize a little bit. So I'll try to keep it relatively brief. So the educational component around the PDMP and its appropriate use is really, really important. And it really, it's one more tool to be used in the tool chest. I think it's a very important clinical tool and needs to be understood in that context. I have a governing board. I had a physician on my board. And right now in the state of Oklahoma, we have a big battle going on because I'm pushing for the PDMP to be used every time you're prescribing a controlled dangerous substance that you are required to check the PDMP. Well, I'm being beaten about the head by the medical associations, which do not want that every time check for that. And I have a board member who came up to me and said, I was determined to prove you wrong on the use of the PDMP. And I've heard several times a prescriber tell me, I know my patient better than anybody else, and I don't need to use the PDMP because I can tell if they're addicted. I know if their, status has changed, and I see some head shakes. And I have to remind them that people who are addicted many times are able to fool the person they live with for the last 20 years. They're able to fool their blood relatives. So to think that you could not fool your prescriber who has 6 minutes with you in that session is kind of missing the opportunity. So use this tool to help you make an informed decision as a prescriber. The board member came to me and he said, I have a confession to make. I was determined to prove you wrong, and he's an emergency room doc, and I hadn't been using the PDMP every time, but I started to use it so I could come back to you and say it's taking too much time, it's never changed my decision making, and it's useless. And he came back. The confession was, on his fifth patient, someone who he had known had actually been lying to him about their utilization of drugs from other prescribers. And in that moment, he used that as an opportunity to really engage with that individual. Said, our prescribing relationship is over. you have someone else that you've been seeing who can prescribe, and I would encourage you to sign a release so that we can have a conversation together. I'm happy to work with you and to work with your other doc, but I will not prescribe as a result of this. So he really used that as a clinical tool, which is the way it's intended. So I think part of the prescribing guidelines is really, really critical. As Paul said, it provides a point of reference, and guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. And everyone will tell you that there are always points of variation with those guidelines, because you need to be able to tailor that. But it at least provides you with that general direction and forces you to think about what you're doing. So am I wanting to go against those guidelines? I better think about that twice. If I've checked that PDMP and they're getting prescription drugs from somewhere else, I need to fully understand that before I then decide to prescribe for that individual. So it doesn't say don't prescribe. It doesn't mandate any particular action. It's a clinical tool so that someone can really use their expertise. It doesn't look like you're convinced with that, though.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I missed the point of my question.
Okay. See, I just wanted to editorialize.
The point of my question is, and this is my experience with my doctor, that the doctor is handed this PDMP. The doctor says, okay, I won't prescribe drugs to anyone. And what happens to the patient? My patient either
Thank you.
Goes to alcohol or goes to heroin. And I'm in a state where there are a lot of programs. And so my worry is, in fact, that by leading this with giving doctors who didn't want to treat my stigmatized patients in the first place, not to me in my own profession, it gives them an outlet. And what they say is, okay, I won't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Goodbye. And that we have not created treatment-specific or real meaningful places for those people to go. And that it's actually very dangerous because doctors didn't like addicts in the first place. Finding out your neighbor is an addict does not make you like addicts more. And we know from training in domestic violence that when you give people who are providers, not just our doctors, when you give people who are providers information and nothing to do with it, you make those providers either feel like they have to be more rigid or that they're not valuable. And so that's my worry, and it's really my worry about the PMP. When I go out and try to convince doctors to get buprenorphine certified, they say, are you kidding? Look at the environment. We'll be penalized. And that's my worry, and I'm worried about what policies we're going to create to respond to that. Not its effectiveness. That's absolutely true. It's what does it mean to take a set of people who believe that what they can do is intervene and give them a tool without intervention?
So I love your passion. We need about 2,000 of you spread across the country with that same level of passion. And I understand the worry now, so thank you for reiterating that. So this is why we are emphasizing the need for that comprehensive approach and the use of concrete tools like ESPRT. So it's not enough just to tell someone no. You need to know what to do with that, and you need to know what resources are available in your communities. The reason that we're emphasizing at the policy level the importance of treatment and recovery is we have to be advocating for that, too. We are in a world of limited resources. We are terrible about cannibalizing this program to pay for that program. Or I'm going to emphasize my area and then underemphasize yours because I'm afraid that you're going to get my resources. We have to push for all of those elements. I think the more times we have individuals like you that understand the risks so that we're making informed strategy approaches, we can minimize those risks. So ESPRT, pushing that out, advocating for increased treatment. That's why I was worried about that decrease in treatment. You know, in the state of Oklahoma, at any time, we have 600 people on a waiting list for treatment beds, right? So now you've increased, not necessarily a mandate, but now a physician has the information at least. So I'm actually trying to help build. I would love to move to Oklahoma. I would love to have more advocates like you. So by increasing awareness of that physician community who can be strong advocates because of very, very well-respected members of the community, they need to be pushing for treatment too, not just the mental health and substance abuse providers. We need to get everybody on board with that. And I think that's increased, you get into a chicken and egg type thing, increased awareness, I believe, is the first step. And many times that's right on the front line. Physicians needing to understand, I don't just get the funny feeling in the back of my neck, which is what I was told by a different provider, I can spot that addict. You actually need to understand the data. And then when you understand the magnitude of the problem within your own practice, I'm hoping you'll become an advocate. But there is a period of time where you obviously have that shortage, where you need to all recognize that, and we need to change it. You're absolutely right about the risk and the concern. I appreciate that. Thank you.
The session ends at 10, so we have plenty of time. I know we've got other questions.
Yeah, so the other point I think is worth, we should stop looking at this as a way of spotting drug users and candymen. We really, again, go back to the comprehensive approach here, because far more people will be helped by this who aren't abusing the drugs than are. So I used to work Friday afternoons in an FQHC. I would get 15 calls, 20 calls for prescription refills. I had no idea who the legitimate patients in there were that really needed a refill versus those who, you know, it's cheaper to get a prescription on Medicaid than it was to go buy a six-pack. So I would have to grill everybody, including those legitimate patients. You don't have to do that with this anymore. You can compassionately treat those people who are taking their medicines appropriately. The other thing is, I agree, we should conceptualize this as a way to identify people for treatment as opposed to as a way to bust people. It's a much more compassionate way, and it's a better use of the tool. I also want to agree with you that people who cut off prescribing in their practice, I think, are abandoning their patients, and I don't think it's responsible. What they've learned, for example, in Maryland, where they go in and they actually shut down a practice, and other states have learned this too, because someone is engaged in criminal behavior, they have to have a whole support team around there to identify who the patients are and get them into treatment. You can't just cut these people off. Anecdotally, my sister works in a drug treatment program, and she recently, they admitted an executive who had slipped into addiction. The doc cut him off like that. He went to heroin, and he came in for heroin admission. So penicillin kills people too. Do we not use penicillin because people anaphylax? Vaccines hurt people sometimes. Do we not use vaccines? Any powerful tool can be good or bad. We just need to use it properly.
I just want to clarify, I'm really realizing we weren't capturing the question. So you're asking specifically about lockboxes as a prevention mechanism and take-back programs.
Okay. Yeah, I think take-back programs are one intervention as part of a broader tool chest, but we CDC don't think it's one of the ones that's really going to turn the needle. We were sort of buoyed by the recent change that allows drugs to be returned to retail pharmacies. But we don't think it's a silver bullet.
So not to contradict my colleague, so it depends on the nature of the problem that we're trying to address. So you have overdose deaths, and the majority of those are not kind of general diversion. But if you look at the misuse of prescription drugs, the NISDA data tell us that the vast majority of individuals who are misusing prescription drugs get those from a friend or a family member. And they're generally getting that because of the oversupply of medications that are available in people's homes. So you have, you know, in the medicine cabinet, you know, you have the Realtors Association, which put out the warning, before you have those open houses, you need to get the medications out of the bathrooms because you have people who are going and just taking those. You have your grandkids over, you're being a good grandparent, you want them to, you know, recreate in the house. Some of the kids' friends are actually going into your bathroom and getting those prescription drugs so they can party on those later in the day. So it's a different objective, but there's a lot of misuse because of inadequate disposal. You know, so if Paul had filled all of those prescriptions. He shared the story. I don't know if you heard that. He would have had basically a great drug supply sitting right there in his house. One of my colleagues talked about, not Michael, but a different colleague, talked about someone who came into her house to do repairs who actually had taken drugs that she had stored in her bathroom. And she just didn't think about it. She just wasn't aware of it. So part of it, how do you get those drugs off the street so they won't be misused? They may not be causing the most deaths, but they are creating a lot of tragedy. So I'm actually a fan of those programs, whether it's a lockbox, whether it's, you know, at the police department or the sheriff's, or whether it's a community take back, you know, where you go and you drop off your batteries and used tires and your unused drugs, so you have a safe way of disposing of those. And also education, and a lot of pharmacies that have taken that on. How do you appropriately dispose? Don't flush it down the toilet. We'll get all our DEQ friends upset about contaminating the water supply. So what can we really do? So it's, again, is it a silver bullet? Absolutely not, because there is no silver bullet. But that's, is it an important part of a comprehensive plan? I think it could be.
I think we can take one or two more questions. I'm losing track. Yeah. So if I'm following you, the question is really, what else should we be considering?
What else should we be looking at? That's right.
So you mentioned naloxone, which is a rescue, and you mentioned prescription drug monitoring, prevention, treatment, recovery, right? This can be prevented, getting out there into communities, preventing the initial use of drugs, and then treatment has got to be there, but we haven't talked about recovery. If we send someone off to treatment and bring them back to exactly the same social environment, they're going to become addicted again, maybe to the same drug, maybe a different one. And we talk a lot about social determinants in public health. Recovery is all about the social determinants. You know, housing, education, jobs. Is there a social environment someone can go that is not a using environment? When people come back out of treatment or out of prison, the stories I've heard, it's anecdotal from our work in substance abuse, is they are sought after by the community. Buy this from me. You know, I got something to sell. They're a potentially hungry user. Or it's a threat to their old social circle that they are not using anymore. So we have to get them an environment where we can go that's safe. So prevention, treatment, recovery. Recovery is all about social determinants. I think that's where we're going in public health.
I think I would just add that I think my view is that we need to optimize better some of the interventions that we talked about. So in with prescription drug monitoring programs, they need to be real-time. Oklahoma's one of very few states that have that. They need to be, you know, Paul talked about proactive reporting, the power of proactive reporting. They need to be, their use needs to be mandated. So it's funding needs to be secure. Doctors need to have access, single sign-on. So in my mind, each of these interventions, they exist, they're not being optimized, and the same is true with some of the other interventions that we spoke about.
So just a quick comment on grants, so I won't stand up and be quick. That really is important, because I know some states are kind of do the checkbox, right? We've done this, we've done that. But it really is about using the tool effectively, so just to reinforce that comment. Congratulations.
Yes. So law enforcement evaluation, and I missed the first one. And media campaigns.
So I think there's been some of programs like Utah's Use Only as Directed media campaign. I can't speak about the law enforcement. And CDC is about to embark on a broader communication, both to consumers and to providers, We're in the process of sort of figuring out how to do that, and evaluation will be a critical component of it.
Is that nationwide?
Is it nationwide? No, right now it's a $250,000 campaign, so it won't be. And by the way, just as a point of reference, the TIPS campaign is a tens of millions of dollars of TIPS for former smokers. So these are expensive endeavors.
So I just want to touch on one thing, because the media campaigns are about informing people. So creating awareness, perhaps creating some motivation, but that in and of itself doesn't work. And I think one of the pitfalls here, and you hear it very often, is we need to educate people. We need to educate providers. We need to educate users. Education is helpful, but wholly insufficient. And to me, the danger of the legislature can say, oh, we created a physician education program, we did something, we're done. Did nothing. I mean, I took a CME for an hour, required by one of my licenses. I think I remembered the stuff 2 hours. Did I really need to know about cytokines in the liver? What did that do for me? So I don't think, we know education doesn't change behavior in the long term. So that's my only caution, is don't let people get off easy by saying we're going to do an educational campaign.
I take one more question, and then we'll be around if people want to come to the front. Go ahead. Your
I agree with everything you just said.
So thank you for that.